Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from Google's Making and Science Initiative. They believe that passion for science and creative problem solving is key to addressing the challenges of today and tomorrow. Young scientists and makers can get started at g.co/makingscience.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. In the search for new antibiotics to counter the growing problem of drug-resistant infections, no stone goes unturned, and that includes the human body itself. Scientists are looking at our own microbes for inspiration, with the idea that they may have developed some helpful weapons in their war to coexist with the rest of the gut, skin, and other flora. The latest promising find? Well, it's right under or inside our noses. Here with that story and other short topics in science is my guest, Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic. Normally, he's in London, but this week, he joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, good to be here.
So, first of all, why go digging around for antibiotics in the nose?
So a lot of our antibiotics come from bacteria in the world around us, and especially in the soil. But the human microbiome, the bacteria that live in our bodies, are a largely untapped source of antibiotics. But they are a potentially valuable one. Our bodies are home to so many different microbes, which are all competing and cooperating with each other. And they have weapons to fight off their rivals. And those weapons might be especially potent in the nose because, unlike, say, the gut or the mouth, the nose is a bit of a nutritional wasteland. It isn't continually washed with food. So the microbes there must be very competitive in order to soak up the meager resources.
So what do they find in the nose?
So they found that a species of bacterium called Staphylobacter, which is found in about 10% of us, makes a chemical called lugdunin, which can kill Staph aureus, the bacterial species that in its antibiotic resistant form is better known as MRSA or MRSA. So this is great. It's a new potential antibiotic that can treat a bacterium which causes some potentially nasty infections and is starting to shrug off a lot of our existing antibiotics. And it comes at a time when no new classes of antibiotics have reached the market for many decades. And even if this promising lead fizzles out, this approach of mining the human microbiome for potential new drugs is, I think, a very sound one. And this study proves that it's a worthy place in which to look.
Very interesting. So let's move on. Tell us who or what exactly is LUCA?
Right. So LUCA, L-U-C-A, stands for the last universal common ancestor. So that is the organism that gave rise to everything that's currently alive on Earth. Every microbe, every animal, plant, and fungus descends from LUCA. It's our great, 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 etc. grandparent. What LUCA was is an open question. But one way of finding out is to take modern organisms and look at their genes and to try and find those that likely date back to LUCA. So genes that are shared throughout the tree of life. When a group led by Bill Martin did this, they came up with a list of 300 plus genes, and these paint an interesting portrait of what LUCA was like. So it likely was a microbe that thrived in hot temperatures. It subsisted on hydrogen for energy, and it shunned oxygen. So it was anaerobic. And that means it probably lived in an environment like a hydrothermal vent, like one of these undersea vents that is belching out hydrogen gases that are really, really hot. There's no oxygen there. It's a very primordial Hadean world, but it's a likely scenario for where the ancestor of all living things arose.
Interesting. I want to move on to a really cool, interesting living thing. Tell me about this. If I were in Mozambique and I wanted to help get some help finding a little bit of honey, what would I do to summon somebody to help me?
Right. So what you want is the greater honey guide, a bird that is known for leading people to sources of honey and that gets exposed bits of beeswax in return. And the Yao people of Mozambique have this special signal, which I'm now going to do a terrible impression of.
I can't wait.
It goes like this. Brr, hmm. So you say brr, you roll the R's, and you go hum, as if like you're asking a question, but you're a little bit irritated at the same time. And that call summons the bird. It's a call that's only ever used for this purpose. The bird seems to understand it, and it responds by flying in the direction of a bee's nest, leading the people there. The people smoke the bees out with fire, and they get the honey, and the bird gets some of the remnants. So it's this beautifully mutualistic relationship between people and a wild animal, and it's one of the few examples of a wild, untrained animal attaching a meaning to a human signal and then responding appropriately.
But again, the birds need us because they can't really deal with the bees and get inside there themselves. They need us to smoke them out and help get inside.
Yeah, that's right. There's some evidence that there are some cases where greater honey guards have been found like stung to death by bees. So without human help, they wouldn't be able to get access to the wax that they so love to eat. So they depend on us as much as we depend on them. Now, the interesting thing is that that relationship sort of breaks down in some parts of Africa, where certain groups of people actually try and bury honeycombs and sort of stop the bird from gorging itself, presumably because keeping it hungry makes it more motivated guide. So that's an open question now. Like, how does that relationship vary from like mutualism to manipulation in different parts of the continent?
There's also a new theory about the origin of one of our oldest and most persistent diseases, tuberculosis, something you've written about. Where did this come from?
Yeah, so tuberculosis has been with us for thousands of years. Today, it still kills more people than any infectious disease, about 1.5 million people. So it's interesting to think where it comes from. And originally, people thought maybe we got the bacterium that causes it from animals. And actually, it seems that it's probably the other way around. So that bacterium, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, was probably originated from a soil-dwelling microbe. It jumped into humans, and then we gave it to the rest of the animal kingdom. So what was the thing that made it start colonizing our bodies and spread from host to host? Well, a couple of Australian scientists think that fire was a possible answer. Because fire does two things. First, it produces smoke, and smoke damages our lungs and our airways, and creates conditions that make it easier for this an opportunistic environmental microbe to colonize. And then fire also gathers people in dense places. People huddle for warmth around fires, and that creates an evolutionary pressure for that opportunistic bacterium to become better at jumping from one host to another.
Wow.
So fire, created the conditions in which an environmental microbe could have taken up shop in our airways, and then gained the ability to spread to new people.
Well, that's the news roundup for this week. Thanks again to my guest, Ed Yong, a science writer for The Atlantic. Thanks so much, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. New Zealand is well known for its beautiful native bird species, many of which have called the archipelago home for millennia. Land mammals, on the other hand, are not native to the island nation. They arrived along with humans about 700 years ago. Since then, nearly a quarter of the country's native birds have gone extinct. Now, after 50 years of futile efforts to save its native avian species, the government of New Zealand is adopting a pretty extreme conservation strategy. The plan is to wipe out an entire population of non-native mammalian predators, including rats, possums, and stoats. Joining us to explain all this is Sarah Dawson, director of the Wolfson Center for Sustainable Environment at Franklin and Marshall College. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what makes these birds so special to the people of New Zealand, and why is it so important to protect them?
Well, I think taking a step back, it's not just New Zealand. Protecting biodiversity is critical across the globe because we depend on it for food and housing and medicines, both known and almost certainly unknown, and we're losing thousands of species each year because of impacts from humans. But islands in particular have a disproportionate amount of unique biodiversity because their species have been evolving in isolation for so long. So though islands comprise only about 5% of land area, they do contain about 20% of all the species on the globe. And so conservation efforts can be more efficient here. But for New Zealand in particular, their unique fauna are also a major economic driver in the form of tourism dollars.
Oh, so people come to see the birds. So this plan calls for eliminating all rats, possums, and stoats, which sounds, frankly, I don't know, Sarah, kind of ghastly. Is this the best way to protect the native birds?
Yeah, you know, it does sound ghastly, but I do think it's a critical component of a comprehensive conservation plan. In addition to invasive species, major causes of biodiversity loss include things like pollution and overharvesting and habitat destruction. And certainly all of these things need to be addressed in conservation, but for many islands and an island nation like New Zealand in particular, they have a cohort of species that have not evolved with predators, which makes them especially susceptible to these predator invasions. And so their ground nesting birds, like kiwis, have no defense against generalist predators like stoats and rats. And so I do think that invasive species control really needs to be their top priority.
Yeah, and kiwis are threatened. This is the national bird.
It is, yeah. Cute little guys.
So where else has a strategy like this been used? Was it successful trying to wipe out all the predators like this?
Yeah, so it's actually been used in some form or another in more than 1,000 other places, mostly islands, and sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully. So recent success stories include getting rid of the goats on some of the Galapagos Islands and pigs from the Channel Islands. Guam with the brown tree snake is probably the most famous case of an unsuccessful invasive species removal. But it is important to note that New Zealand is not at all new to this sort of strategy. They've actually had success already in removing stoats, possums, rats, and also other invasive species from over 100 of their smaller outlying islands. So they're well practiced.
We just have a few seconds left, but is there a worst case scenario? Could something really bad happen by trying this?
Well, you know, I think they need to try. This is definitely the largest scale removal ever attempted. And when we're talking about things like rats and mice in particular, you have species refugia on private lands and in homes. So there's going to be a lot of public compliance and likely assistance necessary. That's going to be difficult. Costs in billions of dollars. And they're talking about using poisons, which will be effective against the non-native mammals, but there could also be some non-target species like domestic dogs being affected.
We'll be watching. Sarah Dawson, director of the Wolson Center for the Sustainable Environment at Franklin and Marshall College. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll look at changing digital language after this break.
Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum. If you are a Trek fan, here's one you can't miss. The Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum is celebrating 50 years of Star Trek and will be the first venue in the United States to host Star Trek the Starfleet Academy Experience. Channel your inner Spock. Immersive experiences let you put your skills and knowledge to the test as you visit 9 zones, focusing on training in language, medicine, engineering, navigation, command, and science. And it's only there till Halloween, so here is a special offer for we Sci-Fry listeners. Just go to intrepidmuseum.com and enter ST Science. That's ST Science, and you'll get $3 off the ticket price. The offer is good for 4 adult, child, or senior tickets only. No other offers apply. So get your tickets today.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Texting has made communicating a lot easier. No more memorizing phone numbers, instant response time, but there are a few pitfalls that can come with it.
Been trying to reach out to you all day. Are we on for tonight?
Shoot. Keegan's been texting me. Sorry, dude. Missed your texts. I assumed we'd meet at the bar. Whatever. I don't care.
Sorry, dude. Missed your texts. I assumed we'd meet at the bar. Whatever. I don't care. Whatever. I don't care. Do you even want to hang out?
Do you even want to hang out? Oh, that's considerate. Like I said, whatever.
Like I said, whatever?
That's Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele from the show Key and Peele. Without the face-to-face interaction, texting and digital conversations can be open to some interpretation. So how do we convey tones like sarcasm online? Are hashtags and emoji becoming a new type of syntax and punctuation? My next guest is here to talk about the creative ways we're communicating online and in the digital space. Gretchen McCulloch is an internet linguist, and she writes the blog All Things Linguistic, and she's based out of Montreal. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
And if you've got a question about how we develop tone and language in the digital space or how you use it, maybe confoundingly at times, you can give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can always tweet us at SciFry. We were talking in the introduction about sarcasm being lost in translation. Why is sarcasm, Gretchen, so hard to convey digitally?
I think sarcasm is difficult because it's got so many layers to it. There are so many different ways to be sarcastic. You can be kind of dry sarcastic, over-the-top sarcastic. There's been a lot of efforts in the past to introduce a particular sarcastic punctuation mark, and none of them have come through because I think the nature of sarcasm is that it leaves open this possibility for misinterpretation, because otherwise you'd be communicating overtly.
You know, we've taken a long time in human existence to try to actually figure out how to be sarcastic to one another face to face, and we're making this up so quickly in the digital space. I mean, are there some pitfalls here of adapting some of these new things so quickly we can really miscommunicate?
I think there's some pitfalls, and particularly making sure to gauge who your audience is. You know, if you're communicating with someone in a different generation as you, maybe you want to give them a little bit more room for ambiguity or benefit of the doubt and not assume they're mad at you right away. They might just be inept.
We always do this on the radio, right? We're talking to someone and we put up air quotes and we realize that nobody can see us. How do you do that online? Your favorite version of online air quotes?
Well, I mean, there are quotation marks, of course, that you can put online. But I really like the very important capitalization, if you will, where you capitalize each word. Sometimes you put a period in between them. And it adds this sense of distance and this sense of exaggerated formality that's not actually there. I think that's really fun.
Let's talk about hashtags. They were used as a type of index on Twitter at first, but it's taken on this whole different meaning. Is the hashtag a new type of punctuation, do you think?
I don't think so much. I mean, the punctuation mark has been around, but what we're using it for is different. I think we're using hashtags to communicate a second channel or a second layer of information that provides context. So you can see this with the indexing type of hashtag. So if you say, you know, wow, Beyonce is amazing, and you hashtag Super Bowl, that means something different than if you say, wow, Beyonce is amazing, and you hashtag Lemonade. Because in one case, you're referring to her new album. In another case, you're referring to a particular performance. And in another case, maybe you're not using a hashtag at all, and you just think this is a generic statement that's true all the time. And I think that people have taken this obvious organizational function of hashtags and the way they add context to what particular event you're talking about or what particular item you're talking about, and extended that to using hashtags to provide context more generally. So a hashtag like sorry, not sorry, no one's going and searching through the hashtags of sorry, not sorry the way they go search through the hashtags of Super Bowl. But at the same time, it provides a certain type of context for why you're saying something in particular or what else is going through your mind at the same time as you're saying the main statement that you're saying outside the hashtag.
Mm. If you have questions for us, 844-724-8255, as we talk about some of the changes in digital language with Gretchen McCulloch. Digital tone, as we've been saying, is so hard to get across at times. We've always been told, right, we're not supposed to write in all caps because it's yelling. Are there some other things that maybe we should avoid that maybe convey something we don't mean to convey?
Well, I mean, sometimes you might want to write in all caps because sometimes you do want to yell. It's just you need to be cautious of what you're actually conveying and that you're conveying what you intended to do in the first place. I think one other example is using internet slang. So things like the letter two for to go or the letter four or just you by itself. For a lot of younger people, those convey a certain type of tone of voice, a certain type of informality, a certain type of relaxed communication, and they're not default. Whereas people in older generations just use those in any kind of text, and they aren't aware that they have a particular tone attached to them. So I think that's one area where you see a kind of generation gap, and where you want to be cautious about who you're communicating with. Mm. There's a comic by XKCD that says, we've arrived at a weird stage where if you write, you know, it's too late with the letter two to do this, you're more likely to be a senator than a teenager these days. And I think that's really true.
Have you ever received a one-word text reply and period, and we're confused about what that might mean? It seems that a period is not just a period when it comes to texting. I want to bring on another guest who has tested this very scenario. Celia Klin is a psychologist at the Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. Welcome to Science Friday, Celia.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So could you talk about this, about using a period at the end of a single word text?
Yeah, we did a really simple study a couple years ago, taking a look at the role of periods in text messages. And our thought really was a fairly simple question to start with. We just wanted to see if the way that people read and interpreted text messages might be in some ways different from the way they read and interpreted, you know, more standard formal language like stories or essays, things like that. So we gave our subjects, who were undergraduates at Binghamton University, a couple of texts to read. So it might say something like, hey, do you want to hang out tonight? And the other person would respond, yup, or sure. And for half the subjects in the experiment, the single word response, yup, sure, okay, was followed by a period. And for the other half of the subjects, there was no period. And we just asked the subjects to rate how much that person wanted to hang out or wanted to go to the movies. And we found, and now we found this consistently across quite a number of studies, that if there's a period following that one word response, our subjects, and we assume texters more generally, interpret that as being less positive or less sincere.
Less positive and less sincere. Why would that be? What is it about putting a period at the end of something that makes it seem off-putting?
Yeah, certainly we asked ourselves that quite a lot. You know, first of all, I want to say I don't think we would have had the same results if the period were at the end of a sentence, right? So a period has a specific meaning at the end of the sentence, and that means the sentence is over, right? But these were very informal and chatty kinds of texts. So I think that period in some ways was over-punctuated. There was something that felt stuffy or too formal about the period. So people went ahead and assumed that that period was in there for some reason, right? It wasn't, you didn't need to tell people you're at the end of the word. You could tell by looking at it. So I think the assumption was that that period carried meaning, and it carried some sort of abruptness, and that made it seem less positive or less sincere.
Well, there's something that people convey in language sometimes, which is when they really want to put the end to a conversation, they'll say, and that's what I mean to say, period. And that might be what you're talking about there, that the period at the end is, this conversation's over.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way of looking at it. I think it did have that kind of feel to it of, I don't want to go to the movies, or I do, yes, I do want to go to the movies, period, we're done. And that conveys something for sure.
Gretchen, I'd love your thoughts on this. What do you think about this study?
I think it's a great study, and it's a great way to put, you know, numbers and like a large sample of people behind what's been an intuition for a lot of people for a long time. I'm just thinking of poetry, actually, which is another thing that uses line breaks for a particular meaning. And you can have a line that ends without a period or without any punctuation in poetry, and then you can have a line that ends with a period. And that means something different because we have these two options available to us. So maybe this double use of the period has been around for longer than we think it has.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about poetry. I like that.
Huh? I want to go to some phone calls. Let's go to Adam, who's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Adam. You're on Science Friday.
Hello there.
Hi. What's on your mind?
All right. Actually, very interesting stuff you got going on there. I'm a middle school English teacher here in Cincinnati. I actually, a lot of times, will encourage my students to use full sentences, proper punctuation, all of that in their text messages, just as a way to practice their formal writing, knowing that they, of course, don't always write formally, but it's a way to get them to use that punctuation more commonly.
And are they taking you up on this suggestion, Adam?
You know, I have no clue.
So they're not texting you too often, are they?
Well, you know, I tend to keep my number private.
Adam, thanks so much for the phone call. Hey, Gretchen and Celia, it's so interesting. I knew that we'd get a call from a middle school English teacher at some point. I mean, it only takes so much time. I mean, there's always this question, I'll ask you first, Gretchen, about whether or not this new way of writing digitally is wrecking the language. If the middle school English teachers are going to have a hard time teaching formal English writing because of the way people text and the way people tweet.
You know, I think that's been a big worry for a lot of people, but there have been studies that show that kids that use more textisms and that text more often are actually better at formal standard English as well, because they just have more chances to express themselves in writing. And I think part of that is because even if you're not sending a formal text message, sometimes you're sending a very important text message. If you're, you know, flirting with someone over text message or breaking up with someone over text message, it's very important that you convey the right tone of voice. And so you're used to putting thought into what you're saying. And that's something that we want to encourage people to write in. I've heard of an interesting assignment that maybe your caller can give the middle school students, which is to take a passage from classic literature and translate it into a text, you know, message conversation. and then take a text message conversation and translate it into formal writing. And this idea that, you know, we can write in multiple styles and registers, and, you know, that you can transfer between the two and that you can have control over multiple varieties is, I think, a really interesting idea for kids.
Celia, do you have a thought about this, about how the digital language that we've adopted is changing formal language?
Yeah, people brought that up a lot when the study came out. But people were, you know, were really angry about what they thought we were suggesting, which was funny because we weren't suggesting anything. We were just looking at what people understood. I don't see this as being dangerous to formal written language. You know, we're used to having spoken language be in many different registers, right? We can chat with our friends. We can give a formal lecture. We don't expect those to be the same. And we have faith that people know the difference. They know when to use one kind of spoken language and when to use the other. I think we're less used to informal written language. That's something new to us, but I believe fully that people know or they can learn the difference between formal written language and informal written language. You know, if anything, I think the extent to which people are so tuned in to very subtle differences in texts, for example, a period versus not a period, to me says sort of the opposite of that we should be concerned. I think it shows that people are linguistically very sensitive and linguistically clever. We create what we need to express what we want to express.
But is there a worry, though, Celia, that without a universal type of language, one that's being created constantly, we really can't communicate across generations, across different parts of the country or different parts of the world, because we're adopting so many different styles, it's hard for us to really communicate amongst each other?
I mean, I think that may be a concern in general about language and communication across the world and across generations. I don't think it's about writing. I think that there is still formal written language. I think we are very tuned into context, who we're speaking to, if it's formal, if it's informal. So I see this as just one more kind of conversation, one more kind of communication. To me, this does not signal the end of, you know, life as we know it.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking about some of the changing digital language that we all face. So let's hear from a high schooler. Fiona's calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Fiona.
Hi. I was listening when you guys were talking about the difference between a period at the end of a one-word comment or response and no punctuation at all. And I found that in my experience, at first, a one-word response a couple of years ago was seemed pretty friendly and enthusiastic, but now people tend to take that as unenthusiastic or upset or a negative response and tend to compensate by using emoticons and exclamation point marks fairly frequently. So I was just wondering if that's something that is that a tendency that's common or...
Huh. Well, let me ask about that. And Fiona, thank you so much for your phone call. I wanted to ask a little bit about emojis anyway, Gretchen. So what do you say to Fiona?
Well, I think that there's something fairly common when it comes to being polite, is that a polite thing is something that takes more effort on the part of the speaker to do. So saying close the window is less polite than would you mind possibly if I were to maybe close the window, just because you've added more stuff there and so you've gone to a little bit more effort to be more polite about it. And so I think that in general, you know, adding emoji or adding extra punctuation, especially if it's not a period, can make you sound more polite or can make it feel like you've gone to a little bit of extra effort on behalf of the speaker, and also potentially a little bit more interesting because you can play around with the emoji a bit.
But that's one of my questions, though, about emoji. There's so many options, and you almost feel if you use them in a text context or online anywhere, that if you are trying too hard, if you're going through all the possible emojis you could use, you could frankly spend all day trying to do it, but you're also maybe making too much of an effort to just convey something simple. Are there downfalls with the way we use emoji right now?
Well, you do find that the most popular emoji are the face and hand emoji, and a lot of people have a small set that they pick from, so they go into their most recent emoji and they just pick from one of those rather than going through the whole list of a couple hundred every time they want to do one. So I think that the way we're solving that problem is by picking from a very restricted set. But I think part of the reason why the face and hand emoji are so popular is because we lack facial expressions and tone of voice and gestures and stuff when it comes to digital writing. And you wouldn't want to have a conversation with a paper bag over your head and in a monotone. So why would you want to do that in a text?
I want to go to one more quick phone call here. Cameron is calling from Plano, Texas. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just had something to add about the sarcasm. You started a conversation about sarcasm. In a forum like Reddit or any other forum where you have a bunch of strangers together, sarcasm, of course, is a very difficult thing to convey. So what we've come up with is after our statement, if it's a sarcastic one, you do a backslash lowercase s. And that's meant to convey that, you know, the previous statement was done in a sarcastic way. And I think it's important to note that when you're texting, you're usually texting with people that are amongst your group of friends. So you're reading in each other's voices. You can kind of infer the tone is without much punctuation. But when you're getting into the larger form, the bigger forms full of strangers, you need more tools at your disposal.
Well, and I think that that's a big, and I'll have to leave it, and Cameron, thank you for that. We'll have to leave it there. And there's so many different ways to communicate across this entire country amongst your friends and amongst strangers. I want to thank Gretchen McCulloch, an internet linguist who writes the blog All Things Linguistic based out of Montreal. Thank you so much. Celia Klin is a psychologist at the Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Hundreds of people have flown in space since cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin orbited the Earth in 1961. But of those hundreds, the 24 who flew the Apollo missions are the only people so far who have left the protection of the Earth's magnetosphere, which shields us from most of the radiation entering the solar system. New research published this week compares those 24 astronauts to those who never left low Earth orbit and concludes that interplanetary travel may boost the risk of heart attacks and strokes, up to 5 times the risk for astronauts that stay closer to home. We're taking a look at that research, plus the bigger picture of how time and space affects astronauts' bodies. How can we help them help to keep them healthy on these long voyages as NASA and SpaceX get ready to send people to Mars? We want to hear from you. What are your questions about space travel and the body? Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can always tweet us at SciFry. My guests are Dr. Michael Delp. He's professor and dean in the College of Human Sciences at Florida State University and author of the new research about the Apollo astronauts. Welcome, Dr. Delp.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Also with us today is Dr. Jeffrey Sutton. He's president and CEO of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute and director of the Center for Space Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Sutton.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, Dr. Delp, let me turn to you and talk about these alarming statistics, a 5-fold increase in the risk of cardiovascular problems for Apollo astronauts. How did you reach this finding?
Well, I think first in starting the study, we were looking at the fact that the International Space Station is scheduled to be decommissioned in 2024. And really around the world, a lot of countries, space organizations, and even corporations have talked about plans to send humans back to the moon and on to Mars within a 10-year time frame from now. And so the question came up, are there any long-term effects of going into deep space to humans? And the Apollo lunar astronauts, the only humans to have done that, we wanted to look and see what their cause of mortality, or cause of death was. And so even though there are 24 Apollo astronauts, really what we looked at were the 7 that had died since 2015. We found that they did have a higher mortality rate due to cardiovascular disease, fivefold higher than astronauts who never flew into space, as well as the astronauts that remained in low Earth orbit.
Of course, 24 total astronauts is a pretty small sample size. So how can we conclude anything from these 7 deaths?
Well, you can't make definitive conclusions. And we say that in the paper, that this is an observation. It is a small sample size. And, you know, any conclusion you draw, it cannot be definitive. But it was statistically significant. And we also felt like it was difficult to ignore the possibility that space travel may be having this adverse effect on the cardiovascular system, even with this small number. And one of the things about research in space is very frequently we are dealing with small numbers, be them human studies or animal studies.
You also did some studies on mice around this as well, though.
Yes. What we found was that we had some, these were all ground-based studies. We simulated a weightlessness. We looked at space radiation, and then we combined the two, looking to see if there was an interaction. And then after these treatments, we waited 6 to 7 months, which was the rough equivalent to 20 human years, to see if there were any long-lasting effects. And what we found was that there was some dysfunction of the blood vessels in the radiation-treated animals, but not the simulated weightlessness. And that was the only effect that we found that really had this long-term sustained effect. And so from that, we concluded that space radiation may have these effects on blood vessels that may predispose these vessels to the formation of plaque.
Dr. Sutton, I'd like to get your reaction. What stands out to you about this research?
Well, I think the research is very important because it demonstrates how one can go about looking at the hazardous effects of space radiation. Space radiation is different than the radiation that we're exposed to here on Earth. We are protected by the magnetosphere. And as we look at different systems in the body, not only the cardiovascular system, as Dr. Delp has done, but also at the brain, at blood, at bone, at other tissues and organs, and also look at the effects of space environment on human adaptation and risks that can take place beyond those caused solely by radiation or the interaction, for example, as Dr. Delp was talking about, between microgravity and radiation. These are all very interesting and important problems if we're going to be able to send humans on long-duration exploration missions beyond low Earth orbit for extended periods of time.
Yeah, NASA looks at about 31 risk areas that they've been researching where astronaut health is concerned. One of them, of course, Dr. Sutton, that we've heard a lot about is how bones weaken in zero gravity, which means that astronauts need to have pretty rigorous exercise routines. How well has that worked out?
It's actually worked out quite well. Certainly, it appears that the longer a person is in the weightless environment, the greater the risk for bone demineralization. And exercise, along with good diet and nutrition, and there are actually some medicines, are effective as countermeasures, singly and combined, in mitigating the risks of bone. But it's complicated. Different astronauts have different individual susceptibilities and predispositions to bone loss. In other words, some lose bone greater than other astronauts do. Bone is lost at different rates in different parts of the body. Not surprisingly, those weight-bearing areas in the skeleton, for example, the upper portion of your thigh bone in the hip area, in the pelvis, tend to lose bone at a greater rate than non-weight-bearing parts of the skeleton.
Some of the other things that we've read about that are interesting, like dust inhalation and a problem there. What's going on with the lungs in space?
The lungs actually do quite well in space. What's not known is what the effects of, for example, lunar or Martian dust would be on the pulmonary system. Lunar dust, for example, since we're talking about the astronauts who went to the moon, is a very unusual substance. It's like fresh fractured quartz, and it tends to get stuck in the bronchial tree. And we need to understand better about the nature of the particular dust on the bodies that our astronauts are going to be going to help prevent problems from occurring.
If you have questions about astronaut health, you can give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. I'm talking with Jeffrey Sutton and Michael Delp and about what we know about the long-term effects of space.
Dr. Delp, getting back to this issue of radiation, a lot of people, I think about the problem of radiation being one tied to cancer. So what could be the other problems outside of that that we might be looking for? Obviously, you're studying heart disease, but what else might radiation cause?
Well, there's new evidence that it has neural effects. And so the neural tissue, the brain and peripheral nerves, may also have a susceptibility to it. In our study, we didn't see any differences in mortality due to cancer, but in the Apollo astronauts relative to the other groups. But I don't think that they were in space long enough. And I think, you know, when we're talking about humans going to Moon or the Mars and having a more prolonged stay, that time in space and the time that they're exposed, I think, will be an important variable that will really requires a lot more study.
We've got a question here from Ryan, who is calling from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi there, Ryan. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. I was wondering if your team does research on physiological degradation of astronauts. If there's any research going on about psychological or mental effects of prolonged space exposure, if that has a similar effect like some of the things that you're studying.
Thanks for the question, Ryan. Dr. Sutton, you want to take that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. There's a lot of work that's done on the physiological adaptation and changes that take place when humans go into space. In fact, it's pretty hard to think of a system in the body that's not affected by weightlessness, fluid shifts, cardiovascular system that we've been talking about, neurovestibular system, many, many different systems change. With respect to behavior, the psychological effects. Of course, the brain is the organ of psychology, and as Dr. Depp was pointing out, we're very concerned about brain health and ensuring astronauts have excellent performance throughout the duration of the mission. Behavioral, psychological, and even psychiatric problems have taken place. They're documented in the public literature, and there's some very interesting analog studies that have also been done. For example, there was a 520-day isolation study done in a chamber in Moscow that was the first high-fidelity simulation of a crewed mission to Mars. And, you know, what basically happens is that, first of all, crew tend to do generally very, very well, careful training and screening and teaming. Nevertheless, the environment's harsh, and one does get concerned about common things, anxiety, a little bit of depression, and it's important that we better understand how astronauts will function for long periods of time in isolated environments. There's some work that's been done and a lot more work that needs to be done.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Dr. Delp, one of the big mysteries that's come up in recent years is the problems that many astronauts have developed with their vision. What exactly happens?
Well, I think some of them, and it's particularly in long-term space flight that this has started to occur, and they lose a lot of their visual acuity. And the NASA started noticing this, and they convened a meeting of national experts in 2010. And there's been a lot of research effort once that problem was identified to really try to figure out exactly what it is. It certainly is related to the fluid shift. It's been hypothesized that it may also have some bearing with the blood-brain barrier, the lymphatics, possible venous congestion of blood leaving the brain area. And the other interesting fact is, if Jeff, you can correct me, is that it's happened exclusively in men, that there have been no female astronauts coming or cosmonauts coming back with that.
Yes, that's right. This is a newly recognized syndrome. It's probably been around for quite some time. It is of concern. We've been talking about radiation, which is the number one risk to astronaut health beyond low Earth orbit. Within low Earth orbit, this spaceflight-induced intracranial hypertension visual alteration problem is the number one problem. And Mike is absolutely right. This is a new syndrome. And speaking as a physician, you know, over the span of your career, you don't see new syndromes all that often. And it's very interesting because of the male predominance. It's been seen in the international crews. And in addition to the changes in vision, many of the astronauts who are affected by this have changes in the retina itself. And that's really the worrisome thing, that there is a swelling of the optic disc, and there is folding that takes place in some astronauts in the retina, and also some areas that appear to be damaged. And some astronauts also may have some elevated intracranial pressure, and that some of these changes may actually persist even when astronauts return from the space environment. So it is a mystery, and work is being done on this. It's a very important area for international collaboration to take place, to be able to better understand the mechanisms and also to mitigate this risk.
I'm wondering, just a couple minutes left, but Dr. Delp, about some of these other mysteries. If we want to send people to Mars sometime relatively soon, what are the other things we need to figure out? I mean, what are the other potential hazards for long-term life in space?
Well, I think, and this is something that I'm not an expert with, but spacecraft shielding. I know there are a lot of smart people out there that have talked about that, but even things that we can control. I mean, Jeff talked about food and nutrition. You know, a lot of experimental work still needs to be done about potential countermeasures, for example, to radiation and how nutritional needs can be met, for example, with antioxidants. Even on Earth, a number of investigators have tested different antioxidant cocktails, and many of them don't work, but occasionally they do. And to find out why they do and, you know, what organ systems are they effective in.
Dr. Sutton, a quick last thought, something else you think we might need to figure out before we send people off to Mars?
Well, I think we have to figure out how we're going to take care of these folks. You know, there's an old saying in medicine that common things are common. So if you send a group of folks away, they're going to have to be able to have ways in which they can take care of each other. So we're looking at a relatively autonomous medical care and healthcare delivery system with the abilities to make remote diagnosis and to have treatments, and to think about new ways that are maybe rather disruptive and revolutionary, involving, for example, 3D printing of resources that can be helpful in treating folks. And we'll have to learn also very much of how to, quote-unquote, like I live off the land, of how to be able to, you know, support ourselves.
Well,
so imagine going on expedition, and
you know, it's
complicated.
We all watch The Martian. I guess that's one way to do it. I want to thank Dr. Jeffrey Sutton at the Center for Space Medicine at Baylor University, and also President and CEO of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, Dr. Michael Delp, Professor and Dean of Human Sciences at Florida State University. Thank you both very much.
Thank
you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
One last thing before we go. Science Friday will be featured on the CBS show Brain Dead on Sunday. Tune in this Sunday evening to see how Ira and Sci-Fry help in solving the mystery of the brain-eating bugs. Sci-Fry Sunday evening on CBS. Very exciting. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler.